sci-fi series Black Mirror has always been about changing technology and its usually dark implications for the future. Its latest episode, Bandersnatch, is itself a result of new technology developed at Netflix.
Bandersnatch is about a programmer writing a choose-your-own-adventure-style video game in the 80s. But as you watch it, you make your own on-screen choices that determine which of several possible endings you reach. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We'll untangle the good, the bad, and the baffling in Bandersnatch on today's show. Joining me and Stephen from the great state of Florida is NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
And before we talk about Bandersnatch, I do want to say I think it's even harder to talk about this without spoiling it a little bit than it is with most things. So if you want to go in cold and you want to spend at least a little time with it, feel free to do that and come back to us in a little bit. I want to ask Stephen first, you are not a Black Mirror guy.
No.
But you did sit down and watch Bandersnatch, I hope.
I did. That would have been rough if I hadn't.
It would. What did you think?
On the surface, this was made for me. I used to devour Choose Your Own Adventure books as a kid, and I played video games of this vintage when I was a kid. This is set in 1984, so was my childhood.
Stop. But, you make me feel so old.
But at the same time, I found myself running up against an issue of stakes. Because this movie is kind of steering you, or you are steering it, I never really have a sense of the story the filmmakers are telling me. So the actual form itself, I found a little bit frustrating. Also, just from a tech angle, I couldn't watch this on my Roku. It gave me like a little 2-minute video of why I couldn't watch it on my Roku.
There are a few systems, including Apple TV, even, that it wasn't optimized for when they put it out. So
yeah, you basically have to have a cursor you can drag, you know, in order to make your choices. So
or a remote. A remote will work.
A remote, yeah. So, you know, I had to grumble over to my computer and then watch it that way. So, like, it's effectively made, but it is running up against this thing of, like, they can only make so many movies, right? It's kind of steering you back to the plot. Sometimes I found myself at times making the most nihilistic possible choice and then only to have the movie be like, okay, go back.
Yeah. Yeah. How about you, Eric? What'd you think?
Well, what I felt, and I think you may have even touched on this in your NPR.org review, is that the mechanism of it, I loved. I felt like the transitions were seamless. I liked the way they presented the choices. And I liked the idea of, well, let's see what it's like when I get to sort of choose where the story goes. But the story itself was not compelling enough.
I agree.
And I think that was the biggest problem with this, is that as you sort of went through it, you kept expecting this sort of larger meaning that we often get from Black Mirror episodes, and it wasn't there.
Yeah.
They were so busy being meta
with
the idea that you're choosing your own adventure, but you're not really choosing your own adventure in the same way that the character is creating this game where people choose their own adventure, but spoiler alert, he eventually discovers the only way to make the game successful is to remove most of the choices for people.
Yeah.
So they did all that great detail work, but the actual story itself was not compelling enough to make me constantly want to revisit it. And so I hope to see this grand experiment that mostly worked used to service, you know, the kind of Black Mirror story where it's either about the impact of technology on us, on humans, or about humans and how we distort technology when we bring our humanness to it, which is when I think Black Mirror most excels, when it tells those kinds of stories.
Yeah, I agree with you. To me, it felt like proof of concept,
right?
But not necessarily a successful use of that concept. It was an interesting experience to actually be making on-screen choices about things that I wanted the character to do, but there was also a little bit of a mix of sometimes it was choosing what the character was going to do, but sometimes it seemed more like choosing the circumstances a little bit more than, you know, making the choice for the character. I'm not sure it's a completely successful execution, but I think it is a mostly successful execution. I was impressed by how, as Eric said, how seamless it was, in the sense that there's no break. There's not like a breaking the video and then buffering, mm-hmm. and then you go to the next scene, which right. is kind of the cheapy looking mm-hmm. version of this. It flows fairly well, although I will say you still have to have 10 seconds to make the choice, which means you still get a lull while the choices are sitting on the screen, mm-hmm. which I do think in some cases really affects the pacing in a negative
way.
It feels like
throat clearing. It also takes away some of the element of surprise. Mm-hmm. You know exactly, like there's one where it's like, yell at dad is one of the choices. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, all right, I'm used to this. This is my life. I'm going to yell at dad.
Right.
And then like there's this wind up and you're like, okay, he's going to yell at his dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the element of ooh, what's going to happen next, has a lot of that element has been taken out of it.
Well, and the tricky thing to me is, on the one hand, I didn't find this story compelling. I agree with Eric about that. But on the other hand, without the kind of meta aspect of it, where there is a lot of fourth wall breaking mm-hmm. and like those moments of surprise were fun for me mm-hmm. where I wasn't expecting it. And then I thought, oh, that's fun. And so without those things, I feel like, you know, there are a couple of Netflix executives who have talked about using this on just like a wacky comedy or a romance or something. But to me, without the meta stuff, then I really wouldn't know why I wasn't just watching a regular movie where a good storyteller had chosen the ending, because it doesn't feel like a game. It doesn't have nearly enough choices to feel like mm-hmm. a game, nor are they frequent enough. Nor are you able to go back and make the other choice, which to me,
right.
when you read a Choose Your Own Adventure book, you can always say, okay, well, I saw what happened there. I'm just going to go right back to where I was.
I suffocated in the cave over here.
Right. So I'm going to go back 5 pages or flip back to where I was. You can't really do that here. It's mm-hmm. all disabled. The fast forwarding and rewinding doesn't really work.
That's a point that I also felt strongly about, was like you make a choice and you kind of go down that road and you sort of say to yourself, oh, man, I wish I had made that other choice. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, you know, I was watching it on my iPad, so maybe your finger slips and you hit the wrong
mm-hmm.
one and you want to go back and you can't, and you almost have to restart it, or you have to follow the adventure all the way to the conclusion of the branch that you're on
right.
and hope that it kicks you back to a place where you can make that choice again.
Right.
And of course it has cheeky little moments where like the therapist talks to Stefan and tells him, you know, you can't go back and remake choices. Well, yeah, you know, actually you can,
yeah.
you uh-huh. know, if you're watching this in certain ways, you know, purely as a pop culture fan, it would have been great if this could have been kind of an open source experiment where the data that Netflix is going to get from all of these choices and all these people watching it was kind of made available to the public. I would love to see what people chose, why they chose it,
mm-hmm.
how many people actually watched it, how many people watched it to the end. There's got to be tons of lessons about what kinds of stories people prefer and why they prefer them and what they're interested in that would come from this.
Right.
And of course, you know, we're not going to learn, you know, hardly any of it because they're not going to tell us. But it would be great to sort of have that made publicly available so that it really could be the turning point in interactive television that Netflix wants you to think this is going to be.
I mean, I'm not sure why they couldn't, wouldn't, or shouldn't issue a cut of this that is the most frequently made choice
mm-hmm.
in each situation and put a version up that you can just watch as a passive viewing experience.
Well, and the thing is, you can do that, right? If you let it run and you don't make any mm-hmm. choices, it has a default, you know, it'll choose the default if mm-hmm. you just ignore it. So then you're watching a movie that just has a bunch of 10-second lulls for no reason. but I think, you know, the other frustration that I had with it was my love of good art, right? My love of good storytelling
mm-hmm.
comes from experiencing someone else's inspiration, someone else's creative inspiration. And I didn't feel with this like there was a particular story that they wanted to tell that had a beginning, middle, and an end. And I feel like when I read a book or I watch a movie, I enjoy seeing what choices the storyteller has made. I don't necessarily want those choices to be kicked back to me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, no, you tell me the story. That's why I'm here.
Yeah.
And with a video game, for example, we did an episode about Breath of the Wild.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about the fact that in the video game Breath of the Wild, you're constantly making small choices and you're constantly seeing new things, and it goes and goes and goes, and you can always look around and see something different and try something different. I think there's a big difference between that, which I think when people talk about it being like a game, ultimately a big storytelling open world game like that would be the ideal, I guess, for something like this. But this isn't anything like that. And in a game, even in a game with these binary choices, I don't think they would ever take you back and make you watch like a 7-minute chunk where that you've already seen.
Right.
Because I messed around with this for about between 2 and 3 hours probably on the morning that it was released to try to see as much of it as I could. And in that time, there were scenes I watched 6 or 7 times, and they're not that interesting.
Right.
They're not interesting enough that I want to sit there and watch the whole thing. And it's kind of like in a video game where, you know, where the god starts talking and explaining the thing to you again, there's usually a skip button.
Right.
Because you don't necessarily need to watch the whole setup and the narration and all the parts you've already seen, which here I did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's talk briefly about the plot, such as it is. It's a young kid. He's 19 years old. He's a video game designer in the 80s. So he's designing a very certain kind of game. And he is, of course, designing a video game that is Choose Your Own Adventure. And the whole plot of the movie really boils down to, like, can he make the game without losing his mind?
Mm-hmm.
But there's really nothing else. There's nothing more to it than that.
Right. And depending on what direction you take the story, there are also things that sort of don't go anywhere. There are characters who don't really ultimately mean very much to the story, depending on what direction you take it in. So it's like, oh, okay, well, I met that guy, and because of the choices that I made, kind of nothing ever happened with that guy. And I think the trick to something like this is making all of the potential paths satisfying, right?
Yeah. I also wonder if this isn't part of a last gasp of culture that is made for people our age. You know?
Yeah, like, no, I like, get that.
We're always looking for that last gasp.
You know,
I'm as journalists.
I'm 46 years old, and like, I'm starting to age out of being the demographic for whom culture is made.
Yeah, welcome to the club, buddy.
And I feel like I would not be loading up on Tangerine Dream futures, you know, because shows about the early to mid 80s are going to start going away, and they're going to, you know, like load up on those Alice in Chains futures.
Or they're going to fully be like shows and movies about the 50s and 60s are, you know, have been for quite a while, which is where
they're reverberations more.
Well, and where they're clearly kind of, they're period pieces in a different way. They're not meant to be the childhood of the person who's watching it. It's very complicated, but I agree with you. And I think the other thing about this was when I wrote about this at NPR, I got a lot of responses where people said, well, you didn't understand it because the point of it is this thing about free will, right? The point of it is you don't really have free will. But there's 10 endings. I mean, they said 5. I would say 10.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have free will in the sense that you're going to get to different endings depending on what as a meta experiment.
And that ultimately was the lesson of the movie. It wasn't that he completely didn't have free will. It was that he was the most successful when his choices were limited.
Yeah, well, and depending on what you think successful is, do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I agree with Eric that as a Black Mirror episode that reflects upon technology, I did not find it particularly. It doesn't have the strong point of view about its subject that I associate with my favorite Black Mirror episodes. I'll send you a list, Stephen. You can check out some that are a little more satisfying.
Well, if only there were some sort of, say, pop culture happy hour newsletter where you could list some of those recommendations for the nice people.
Absolutely. I will list those recommendations in this week's newsletter. Meanwhile, tell us what you think about Black Mirror Bandersnatch. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Royal Caribbean, who invites you to discover that adventure doesn't happen if you just go along for the ride. With Royal Caribbean, you can tell gravity to take a flying leap as you skydive at sea. Take a new culinary world tour on board every night and discover different island destinations all in one trip. Why just vacation in the Caribbean when you can go on an adventure with Royal Caribbean? Come seek at royalcaribbean.com. Ships Registry, Bahamas. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Sci-Fi. From executive producers The Russo Brothers, survival is extra credit in Sci-Fi's new series, Deadly Class. Set in the unsanitized counterculture of the 1980s, a disillusioned teen is recruited into King's Dominion, a secret academy for the deadly arts. Based on the graphic novel by Rick Remender and Wes Craig, Deadly Class premieres January 16th on Sci-Fi. Watch the first episode now at deadlyclass.sci-fi.com.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy This Week. Stephen, Happy New Year, Thompson. What is making you happy this week?
Well, we have just come out of the season in which we share pop culture with a wide range of relatives. And so what is making me happy this week is the Ellen DeGeneres Netflix special Relatable,
nice,
which is perfect to watch with absolutely every one of your relatives, mm-hmm, because it is fun and funny and nice and safe. Yeah. I was actually at a gathering in Spokane, Washington of multiple generations, and we ended up watching it twice because that was what everyone, because somebody else kind of drifted in. It's like, oh, what can we watch? What is totally safe? Mm-hmm. What will everyone enjoy? Relatable, mm-hmm, by Ellen DeGeneres. The title refers to the fact that Ellen DeGeneres is in this interesting place where she tells a lot of stories about life that are very approachable and relatable. And she is accustomed to being kind of this comedian that everyone can get behind because her stuff is so fun, but also safe. But at the same time, she is a fabulously wealthy and successful celebrity.
Yeah.
And so she mines a lot of humor from kind of from the juxtaposition between those two things. You know, it's a very fun, very painless hour of just purely enjoyable television. Who doesn't like Ellen DeGeneres?
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Eric Deggans, what is making you happy this week?
Man, I feel bad because you guys always say what's making you happy, and I always go, well, this is exactly making me happy.
You do. You go for the it's making me curious.
I go for the it's making me curious, or in this case, it's making me angry. But it's really important. So there is this amazing documentary that is going to be on Lifetime in three installments called Surviving R. Kelly. And if you haven't heard about it yet, you have got to check it out. Dream Hampton, the cultural critic, is sort of the showrunner of this. And they basically assembled a team and they went and they talked to everyone that they could get to talk to them who was connected to the R&B singer R. Kelly to investigate these claims that he has consistently for decades had sexual relations with underage women, that he's controlled them to an extent that is almost cultish, that he has developed this coterie of women that he's cut off from their families and their friends and made them totally dependent on him. It's amazing to me that we're in this world where people are debating online about whether Louis C.K. should come back, or a discussion about the N-word that happened on a HBO special back in 2009. When we have a relatively successful R&B singer who has been credibly accused of sort of horrific sexual crimes against young girls, and people seem to act like they have amnesia about it. And so this documentary is in three parts. It airs over 3 days, and it starts on January 3rd. I would suggest everyone check it out and really get to know the story of R. Kelly, because the concern is that the reason why this isn't a bigger issue is because almost all of his victims have been, or alleged victims, have been young black women. Mm-hmm. And society doesn't care about those kinds of people as much as they care about other kinds of people. And so people have turned a blind eye to it because they'd rather believe the I Can Believe, I Can Fly version of R. Kelly rather than this very dark, abusive version that this documentary makes a case for.
As I said, understand why happy is not exactly the word, but a meaningful,
important.
Yeah, a meaningful and important contribution. Thank you, Eric Deggans. What is making me happy this week? There is a film that went directly to Netflix this year, well, last year, 2018, called Private Life, and it stars Kathryn Hahn and Paul Giamatti as a couple who are struggling with infertility. It was written and directed by Tamara Jenkins, who also made The Savages and some other films. And, you know, I don't always like infertility stories about people in their 40s because it can seem kind of wacky. They can make it seem kind of wacky when they're talking about the, you know, the injections and the clinics and the doctors and those things. And I know enough people who have really kind of been in great pain over this issue that I don't always go for those things. That's not what this film is. It is funny in places for sure, but it's really about this couple and their relationship and how it's affected by this struggle in their lives. It avoids a great many cliches that I have come to expect from stories like this. And the performances from Kathryn Hahn and Paul Giamatti are really thoughtful and moving. It's a less, if you're used to kind of the more goofy version of Kathryn Hahn from sitcoms and things like that, this is a much more restrained performance from her. The film is really smart, and I think, unfortunately, one thing that sometimes happens with Netflix films, they don't quite feel like movies for the purposes of movie critics, so they sometimes don't quite make that coverage, and they don't quite feel like television for television critics, and they don't quite make that coverage. But this is a film. It played at film festivals. It is a movie, but you can find it on Netflix, and I don't think it suffers at all from the fact that it's presented at home. It's nominated for 3 Independent Spirit Awards, and I could not recommend it more. Again, Private Life, starring Kathryn Hahn and Paul Giamatti, and that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Eric at Deggins. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. Our producer, Vincent Accavino, at V. Accavino. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music that you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. If you want more from us, including those Black Mirror recommendations and links to what made us happy this week, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.